Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're taking a fascinating trip back to the 18th century to crack open one of history's greatest technological enigmas.
It's a really incredible story.
It is. It's a marvel of both engineering and deception that captivated the Western world for nearly a century. We're talking about the Mechanical Turk.
Also known as the Automaton Chess Player, or its German name, the Schachtürke.
And our mission today is to go far beyond just saying.
There was a man inside.
Exactly, because that's the easy part. We want to unpack the sheer genius, the artistry that was required to maintain this legendary illusion. It debuted in 1770 and was exhibited for 84 years, all the way until 1854.
It's not just a passing parlor trick. That's the key thing to understand. This was the ultimate piece of, pre-digital showmanship.
A machine that seemed completely autonomous.
And capable of high-level intellectual competition. But it was, in reality, a masterful collaboration between human ingenuity and just incredibly intricate mechanical camouflage.
And when you consider the scope of this deception, I mean, the psychological impact is just staggering.
Oh, absolutely. This machine wasn't just, defeating some local amateurs in a pub.
No.
It toured all across Europe, across America, winning games against figures of immense global stature.
We're talking about people like Napoleon Bonaparte, Benjamin Franklin.
And the fact that the secret that a highly skilled human chess master was hidden inside was kept largely intact for over 8 decades. I mean, that's just mind-boggling.
Especially with all the scrutiny from scientists, engineers, skeptics.
It just speaks to the absolute mastery of the illusion's design.
It really redefined what people thought was possible with, automation and intelligence. So let's unpack this right away, because the entire trick really begins with the psychology and the architecture of the cabinet itself.
Absolutely. We have to start with the origin story. Yeah. The Turk was constructed by an Austrian courtier and inventor named Wolfgang von Kempelen.
And Kempelen, he wasn't a magician by trade, right?
No, not at all. He was a legitimate engineer. He specialized in things like hydraulics and steam engines, but he had a competitive streak. And that streak was triggered, I believe, in 1769 when a French illusionist, a man named François Pelletier, visited the court of Empress Maria Theresa of Austria.
That's the story. Pelletier performed some magnetic tricks that impressed the Empress, but Kempelen apparently felt that his illusions were a bit superficial.
A bit cheap?
Yeah. So he boasted publicly that he could return within a year with an invention that was far superior, far more profound.
It was basically a dare.
It was. And Kempelen delivered. He completed the Turk and presented it to the court in 1770. And the machine itself was immediately striking, designed to project this air of exotic intellectual mystery.
Let's visualize it for a second. The Turk wasn't a full body, was it?
No. It was a life-size model of a human head and torso. And it was resting on this big cabinet. It had a distinct black beard, these sort of penetrating gray eyes, and was famously dressed in heavy Ottoman robes and a turban, which tapped into that whole 18th century fascination with Oriental themes.
Exactly. When it was at rest, its left arm held a long Ottoman smoking pipe, and the figure sat behind this massive cabinet, which was the true nerve center of the whole operation.
How big was the cabinet?
It was roughly 3.5 feet long, 2 feet deep, and maybe 2.5 feet high, with the chessboard fixed right on top.
And that cabinet, as you said, was the key. Kempelen knew the second he introduced a machine claiming to play chess, the audience's number one goal would be to find the hidden human.
So how do you defeat that?
How did he design the cabinet interior to defeat the skeptical human eye?
Well, it was a masterclass in staged misdirection. It exploited the human tendency to assume that what you can see is the whole truth.
So what was the first step in the demonstration?
Kempelen would first open the front doors on the left side of the cabinet, and here the audience would see just this dense flurry of complex brass levers, gears, and cogs.
Designed to look exactly like the intricate clockwork of a complicated automaton.
Exactly. But this mechanism was only part of the deception because it didn't extend the full depth of the cabinet.
Right.
And Kempelen would demonstrate this by opening the rear doors on that same left side, seemingly allowing the audience to look right through the dense machinery.
So they see brass, they see movement, and they think, okay, there's a clear line of sight. No human could possibly be hidden in that half.
Precisely. Then he'd shift the demonstration over to the right side of the cabinet.
And this side was completely different.
Totally different. It had almost no machinery at all. Instead, it contained things like a soft red cushion, some brass structures, and a drawer where the chess set was supposedly stored.
And again, he opens the front and back doors at the same time.
At the same time. Mm. providing that clear, unobstructed line of vision through the machine from one side to the other. So the audience saw complexity on one side, emptiness on the other, but they always felt like they saw through the whole depth of the machine at some point.
What's so fascinating here is that the audience saw evidence that should preclude a human presence. They saw visible mechanisms and clear space. But it all relies on the fact that they never saw the whole cabinet volume revealed at once.
And that is where the true genius, the hidden architecture, comes into play. The sliding seats.
The famous sliding seat.
The visible clockwork on the left and the chest drawer on the right. They only extended about one-third of the way back.
So the rest was empty.
The remaining two-thirds of the cabinet was a hollow, empty cavity. And inside that cavity, Kemblin installed a sliding seat mechanism on light rails.
This allowed the operator, who had to be, what, small and very flexible, to physically maneuver themselves inside the box.
Exactly. The sliding seat allowed a small adult or a highly trained individual to shift their entire body around inside the cavity, constantly evading the audience's view as Kemblin opened the doors section by section.
So, for example, when Kemblin opened the front left door to show the clockwork,
the operator would slide to the back right, hidden in the shadows. When Kemblin moved to open the back right door, the operator would slide forward and to the left.
And this movement didn't break the visual continuity of the machine. How did that work?
No, because the act of the operator sliding their seat triggered a counteraction. Dummy machinery or sliding panels would move into place to fill the space the operator had just vacated.
That's brilliant.
So whether a door was open or closed, the space either appeared full of mechanisms or it appeared empty with a clear view through. The audience was just. They were convinced they saw the full, empty volume of the cabinet, section by section. It was the engineering of psychological conviction.
It's an incredible piece of early engineering psychology. But okay, now that we know where the operator was hiding, crammed into this dark, confined, and certainly hot space,
right,
we have to address the second great mystery. How did this person, unable to see the external world, actually play high-level chess?
Well, the mechanism for sight and communication was surprisingly effective, and it was entirely non-optical.
It was all magnets.
All magnets. The chessboard on top of the cabinet had a relatively thin playing surface. And critically, each individual chess piece had a small, strong magnet attached to its base.
So the game on the outside was communicating directly with the operator on the inside through magnetic force.
Precisely. Underneath that thin board, Kemblin had installed small pieces of metal, or strings, connected to tiny indicator magnets. When an opponent moved a piece on the outside, the strong magnet in the base would attract the corresponding indicator underneath, causing it to shift position.
And the operator could see this.
The operator could see these internal magnets or strings move, telling them which piece had been moved and, crucially, where it landed.
Okay, that solves the what and where of the move. Hmm. But the operator is completely in the dark, so they needed some kind of internal reference map.
Absolutely. The underside of the board, which the operator saw by the flickering light of a candle, was meticulously marked out with squares numbered 1 to 64.
So as the external piece moved, the internal mechanism would point to a number, giving them crystal clear positional clarity.
Exactly. Allowing the operator to follow the game perfectly, square by square, without ever seeing the opponent or the room.
Now for the final and maybe the most complex part of the process, controlling the Turk's physical movements. The operator had to somehow translate a precise small movement inside that cramped cabinet into a large human scale movement of the automaton's arm.
This was done using an intricate internal mechanical linkage centered around a pantograph mechanism.
A pantograph. For those of us who don't know, what is that?
It's essentially an instrument used for copying drawings. It allows the user to scale a movement up or down while keeping the same trajectory.
So the operator wasn't moving the arm directly?
No, not at all. Inside, the operator worked with a miniature pegboard chessboard. They would use a metal pointer or a handle and guide it over their internal board. This small movement was then mechanically linked to the Turk's external left arm via the pantograph, which scaled the movement up to the correct size.
So if the operator moved their pointer from E2 to E4 inside?
The Turk's arm moved the piece from E2 to E4 on the outside.
And how did it actually grasp the piece?
The operator had a set of specialized levers. One lever controlled the up and down movement of the arm, lifting it off the board. A separate lever controlled a sophisticated internal linkage that opened and closed the Turk's hand.
That sounds like it required immense precision and practice.
Oh, incredible skill. I cannot stress enough the physical difficulty of this job. Imagine Being crammed into a box barely larger than a coffin, it's pitch black, it's hot, you're calculating complex chess moves.
And simultaneously performing these delicate, scaled mechanical movements with a pantograph, all while trying not to bump the side of the cabinet.
And you mentioned the heat and the light, which brings up another layer of mechanical misdirection.
The candle.
Right. The operator needed light, so they used a candle. But burning a candle in a confined space creates a few problems. Heat, smoke, and a lack of oxygen.
So how did Kempelen manage the smoke ventilation without giving away that there was a hidden lamp inside?
He used the Turk's exotic presentation to his advantage. A small series of ventilation tubes led from the lamp, channeling the smoke and heat upwards through the Turk's body. Out through the turban. And this smoke was then conveniently disguised by the smoke coming from other candelabra that were strategically placed where the game was being played. Just another layer of the illusion.
It's astonishing how Kempelen thought of everything, right down to the atmosphere. But the performance wasn't just about mechanics. It was about authority. The Turk acted like a highly intelligent, maybe slightly temperamental being.
Absolutely. Kempelen was the showman. He made sure the audience remained focused on the machine's supposed intelligence. He would walk around the room during matches, you know, loudly asking the Turk if it was ready.
Right, to show he wasn't manipulating it.
Exactly. He even encouraged observers to test the cabinet with iron bars or magnets, proving it wasn't operated by some external lodestone, which was a common theory at the time.
And the Turk was a rigid enforcer of the rules, which added to this air of authority.
It was programmed to appear sentient. The internal mechanism allowed the operator to trigger certain signals. For instance, the Turk would nod twice if it threatened the opponent's queen.
And three times for check.
Three times for check. Behavior suggesting foresight, comprehension.
And the famous reaction to cheating is the ultimate example of this.
Indeed. There's the famous anecdote from Louis Dutens, a traveler and author. Dutens, like many others, tried to test the machine's limits. He gave his queen the move of a knight, an illegal move.
And the Turk's reaction was what?
It was a three-tiered escalation. First, it shook its head, sort of in disapproval, and moved the piece back. But Dutens tried it again.
And the Turk escalated the punishment.
It removed the piece entirely and then just took its own turn, basically forcing Dutens to forfeit a material advantage.
Yeah.
That kind of behavioral complexity convinced people it had a moral or intelligent understanding of chess rules.
And to further cement this idea that the Turk was an intelligent machine capable of abstract thought, it performed feats beyond just standard chess games. The most famous was the Knight's Tour.
Ah, yes. The Knight's Tour is a classic, notoriously difficult puzzle. It requires the knight to visit every single square on the board exactly once.
Which requires immense forward planning. For the Turk to do this flawlessly from any starting point must have been a staggering demonstration of computational ability to an 18th century mind.
Of course. But the solution wasn't computational power.
How is it done?
It relied on the same internal pegboard system. The operator had access to a pre-marked laminated pegboard that contained a closed-loop solution or a reentrant tour.
Closed-loop.
Meaning the knight can move from the last square back to the first. Because the solution was a closed loop, the operator could start at any square and just flawlessly follow the pre-marked path.
So it was a demonstration of a perfectly memorized algorithm rather than calculation.
Precisely. And the Turk could even communicate.
That's right. Beyond the nods and headshakes.
Yes. It could converse with spectators using a letterboard in three languages, English, French, and German. People would ask questions, and the operator would use the pantograph to point the Turk's arm at letters on a big external board to spell out answers.
And people kept records of these conversations.
They did. Mathematician Carl Friedrich Hindenburg kept extensive records, detailing the Turk's humorous or evasive answers about its age, its marital status, or, inevitably, its secret workings.
It sounds like an overwhelming success, but moving into the era of its famous opponents, it's worth noting that the creator, Wolfgang von Kempelen, he seemed genuinely frustrated by his own invention.
He had an almost bizarre contempt for it. Kempelen was a serious engineer, fascinated by mechanisms that replicated human function, like his speech machines.
And he saw the Turk as a distraction.
He frequently dismissed it as a mere trifle. He often called it a burden because of the constant demands for maintenance and exhibition.
He even dismantled it at one point, hoping to be rid of it.
That's right. After its initial run, he just took it apart. But Emperor Joseph II, realizing the diplomatic and novelty value of the machine, ordered Kempelen to reconstruct it for a Russian state visit in 1781.
And that led to the big European tour.
It did, starting in 1783. And that tour pitted the Turk against the best minds in Europe, the game against François-André Danic and Philidor. That's legendary.
Philidor was considered the best player in the world at the time.
A true champion. He was a musical composer known as the greatest chess player of the 18th century. He played the Turk in Paris in 1783, and he won.
He won, but it wasn't easy.
Not at all. His son later recounted that his father described it as his most fatiguing game of chess ever. The mental strain of competing against a machine that responds with unnerving speed must have been enormous.
The Turk's final game in Paris was against an American icon, Benjamin Franklin.
Yes, who was serving as the American ambassador to France. Franklin was fascinated by technology and trickery, but he was also inherently skeptical.
And the Turk beat him.
The Turk won. And Franklin remained interested in the automaton for the rest of his life. It's noted he kept a copy of a book by Philip Thicknesse, which was one of the early attempts to expose the trick.
So even during Kempelen's time, people were actively trying to figure it out. The general idea was that it had to be a human, but the method was a total mystery.
Oh, they speculated endlessly. Thicknesse insisted the Turk concealed a small child, maybe an amputee. Another popular theory was that the operator was a dwarf, a famous chess player. The genius of the sliding seat was that it completely defeated visual inspection.
Which is why even intelligent skeptics stuck to these wild theories that just didn't fit the mechanics of the cabinet.
Exactly.
Now, Kempelen finally sold the Turk not long before his death in 1804. And this leads us to the figure who truly propelled the Turk into myth, Johann Nepomuk Melzel.
Melzel was a highly ambitious Bavarian musician and inventor. He's famous in his own right for inventing the metronome, but he was fundamentally a showman.
And he bought the Turk in 1805 for 10,000 francs.
Half of Kempelen's initial asking price, which really shows you Kempelen's continued lack of faith in its value. And Melzel's goal wasn't just to operate the Turk, but to dramatically improve the illusion.
He enhanced the theatrics a lot, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. He spent nearly a decade restoring and upgrading the mechanism. During this time, he installed a sophisticated voice box, allowing the Turk to audibly say, "Échec."
French for check.
Right. And that just increased the machine's perceived personification and emotional impact.
And Melzel's era gave us the most famous anecdote of the Turk's career, the confrontation with Napoleon Bonaparte.
This meeting, supposedly in 1809 at Schönbrunn Palace, has become legend. Napoleon, always theatrical, decided to challenge the machine in an unconventional way.
He took the first move.
He just moved his piece first, which wasn't customary. And Melzel, recognizing the challenge, allowed it.
And Napoleon immediately tried to cheat.
Of course he did. He attempted an illegal move. The Turk's first response was restrained. It just returned the piece to its original square. But Napoleon, testing its resolve, tried the illegal move a second time.
And this is where the machine escalated the drama.
It did. The operator responded by escalating the punishment. This time, the Turk removed the illegally moved piece from the board entirely and took its own turn.
But Napoleon being Napoleon.
He pushed until he reached a wall. He attempted the illegal move a third time.
And the machine had clearly reached its limit.
Yep. At this point, the Turk, with a sweeping motion of its arm, knocked every single piece off the board, decisively ending the game.
Wow.
It was a dramatic, definitive statement of mechanical authority. And Napoleon, rather than being angry, was reportedly hugely amused. He then played a proper game, only to tip over his king in surrender after 19 moves.
Even if parts of that story are exaggerated, the fact that Napoleon was publicly tested and defeated by this machine added immeasurably to Melzel's fame and the Turk's mystique.
It made Melzel a very wealthy showman. He profited immensely. At one point, he sold it, but quickly realized he'd sold his primary source of income. So he negotiated its repurchase and eventually set his sights on the hugely lucrative market in the United States.
The North American tour began in 1826, and it was an absolute sensation.
The Turk was wildly popular. Melzel brought his key operator, William Schlumberger, a highly skilled player from Alsace. Schlumberger was the hidden genius who defeated thousands of Americans. And it was during this tour that the machine captured the attention of Edgar Allan Poe.
Poe observed the Turk in Richmond, Virginia, and published his famous 1836 essay, Melzel's Chess Player.
Poe's analysis was dazzlingly insightful on the psychological elements, but mechanically, it was deeply flawed.
What was his main argument?
His central hypothesis was that if the machine were truly an automaton, it would always win. Since the Turk occasionally lost, it must be operated by a human.
Which is an interesting idea, but it fails to account for the reality of chess. A perfect computer can't exist, only a computer that plays its best game.
Exactly. Poe's error was thinking mechanism implied infallibility. He also got the physical mechanism wrong, hypothesizing the player sat inside the Turk figure itself, not the cabinet. But his essay was so widely read, it became the default, though incorrect, explanation for decades.
Poe's intellectual examination aside, the true accidental exposure of the secret came about through something much more human, the sheer suffocating heat of the cabinet.
This is maybe the most dramatic moment in the Turk's history. The definitive accidental exposure happened in Baltimore in 1827. The conditions inside for Schlumberger were always brutal.
Can't even imagine.
Especially during the summer. And the heat was so intense during one performance that William Schlumberger actually fainted inside the cabinet.
Oh my God.
In a panic, sensing he was losing consciousness, he desperately signaled Melzel to stop the game. But before Melzel could fully control the situation, Schlumberger, in his desperation, was forced to quickly exit the cabinet for air.
And someone saw him.
This exact moment was witnessed by two observant teenagers who happened to be watching from a nearby rooftop.
The Baltimore Gazette published the story immediately, but the public reaction tells us so much about the desire to believe.
It does. Despite a first-hand account, the public was highly resistant. Many people, including major news sources like the National Intelligencer, refused to believe it.
Yeah.
They dismissed the exposure as Melzel's own clever publicity stunt.
So the myth was just more appealing than the mundane truth.
Much more. And Melzel, realizing the exposure didn't hurt ticket sales, if anything it boosted them, just continued his lucrative American tours. But the reliance on human talent was the machine's ultimate vulnerability.
And that vulnerability was exposed tragically.
While touring Havana, Cuba in 1838, the brilliant operator William Schlumberger contracted yellow fever and died.
And Melzel?
Melzel. Without his indispensable hidden genius, already deeply in debt and reportedly struggling with heavy drinking, died at sea that July during his return trip to the U.S. His machinery, including the Turk, was left with the ship's captain as collateral.
It was eventually acquired by Dr. John Kearsley Mitchell, a friend of Poe, who restored it and eventually donated it to the Philadelphia Museum.
And there it sat, giving occasional, less spectacular performances. It had survived its inventor, its impresario, its operators, but its luck finally ran out.
The end came suddenly on July 5, 1854.
A massive fire started at the National Theater in Philadelphia and spread to the neighboring museum. The Turk was completely destroyed.
And Mitchell's son arrived too late.
He did. But he famously claimed that through the roaring flames, he heard the final words uttered by the machine.
A check.
Check. Check. Check.
A dramatic, almost theatrical final farewell. And it wasn't until after its destruction that the full secret, the sliding seat magnetic indicators, was finally revealed to the world.
Yes. The full mechanism was publicly revealed by Silas Mitchell himself in the Chess Monthly in 1857. He noted that although hundreds of people had guessed parts of the secret, no single account had ever accurately described the entire mechanism while the machine still existed.
So since it was destroyed,
there was no longer any reason to conceal this ancient enigma.
It took 84 years of operation and another 3 years after its fiery death for the complete truth to be officially documented.
And that leads us to the enduring legacy, which is so much bigger than just a parlor trick. The Turk's impact stretched into legitimate technological inspiration. It profoundly influenced the thinking behind the Industrial Revolution.
You mentioned Edmund Cartwright before. Can you elaborate on that connection between a chess hoax and a major industrial innovation like the power loom?
Certainly. In 1784, Cartwright, an English inventor, visited the Turk in London. And the mechanical complexity of it, even knowing it might be a trick, fundamentally altered his perspective on engineering.
So it gave him a new benchmark for what was possible.
Exactly. He was thinking about the laborious manual process of weaving, and he publicly questioned whether constructing a legitimate machine like a power loom could really be more difficult than building this chess-playing automaton.
So the Turk demonstrated the public appetite for complex machinery and forced engineers to reconsider the limits of what a machine could do.
It gave them confidence. He patented the prototype for the power loom, a key driver of the Industrial Revolution. Within a year of seeing the Turk,
So the Turk, despite being a fraud, helped create the mindset necessary for true automation.
It absolutely did. And while it relied on human power, it set the stage for genuine computational machines. True, non-human chess-playing automata didn't emerge until 1912 with Leonardo Torres Quevedo's El Ajedrecista. The Turk proved the concept of an intelligent machine which fueled the scientific quest for the real thing decades later.
Okay, let's turn to its legacy in popular culture, because even after the secret was revealed, the myth continued to evolve, often based on completely inaccurate accounts.
This is a fascinating aspect. Much of the enduring folklore comes from a fictionalized memoir written by the French magician Jean-Eugène Robert Houdin.
The father of modern stage magic.
The very same. And his account became the version most people believed, even though it was factually incorrect about the mechanism.
He's the one who popularized the myth of the Polish officer.
Yes. The myth of an operator named Woruski, a skilled player whose legs had been amputated in a war, allowing him to fit in the cabinet. It was far more romantic and dramatic than a small guy on a sliding seat. And this myth, created decades after the Turks' destruction, cemented itself in the popular imagination.
And this fictional myth then inspired countless pieces of art and film.
Precisely. The romantic, tragic story of the limbless Polish officer inspired the classic 1927 silent film, The Chess Player, and numerous novels, like The Chess Machine in 2007. The Turk lives on not as the reality of a sliding cavity, but as the myth of a tragic, hidden hero.
Okay, we can't talk about the legacy without discussing the most famous modern parallel, Amazon's crowdsourcing platform, Mechanical Turk.
Or MTurk. This naming choice is just brilliant. It perfectly closes the historical loop.
Amazon launched it in 2005.
Right. And it's a service that lets businesses outsource tasks like identifying images or translating ambiguous text that are currently too complex or nuanced for full computer automation.
They are essentially admitting that what looks like seamless automation is actually powered by a vast, hidden human workforce.
Exactly. Amazon explicitly named the service after Kempelen's hoax. They recognize that sometimes the most effective solution isn't true artificial intelligence. It's what they call artificial intelligence. Human ingenuity hidden in plain sight, scaled up by technology.
It's a perfect, self-aware parallel to the 18th century automaton that defeated Napoleon.
It really is.
What an incredible story of ambition, engineering psychology, and enduring myth. The Mechanical Turk really stands as this powerful historical marker.
It truly does. It demonstrates our persistent fascination with automation, our willingness to suspend disbelief when presented with such a masterful illusion, and the powerful impact that the idea of an intelligent machine can have on real-world progress, even if the machine itself was a fraud.
So here's where it gets really interesting for me. We know the secret of the Turk was a man hiding inside, meticulously calculating the moves. But given that technology has since advanced to the point where computers like Deep Blue can legitimately defeat the world's best human players.
As happened in 1997.
Right. So does the human operator inside the Turk represent the beginning of AI, the earliest effort to automate human-like intelligence, or does it represent the very end of pre-digital showmanship?
It raises the question of whether the true historical significance lies in the clever mechanics of the hoax or in the human intellectual labor that the machine was designed to obscure. It was the human player who made the Turk intelligent, but it was the mechanical cabinet that allowed us to imagine a future where the machine did the thinking.
A profound thought.
So I'll leave you with this to consider. What are the hidden humans powering the automation we all rely on today?
A fascinating thought to leave with, indeed. That was the deep dive into the Mechanical Turk.